This is the Get a Life Podcast, Ex-Cult Conversations.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Get a Life Podcast, Ex-Cult Conversations. We are here today talking about all things related to the Exclusive Brethren, or now it's known as the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church. I am Cheryl Hope, an ex-member from Maple Creek, Saskatchewan, Canada, and I left in 1992 due to child sexual abuse, trafficking, and abuse from priestly visits. Today, I have Ben Woodbury with me from Sydney, Australia, where he attended their private schools. Ben had to leave the PBCC, the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church, due to being gay, where in the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church, that is not allowed. Ben's story can be found on episode 36 and episode 40, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Ben also can be found on all social media platforms as Ex-Cult Boy and has many, many videos on the Exclusive Brethren and the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church. Today, we are here to sit down with a former One School Global teacher and listen to her experiences working for them. As you know from episode 61 and episode 62, One School Global teachers usually need to keep themselves anonymous, not only for their safety, but due to the enormous amount of kids inside that they have helped. We are going to refer to this teacher as Jane. So welcome, Jane, and welcome, Ben.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today. Jane, I'm going to hand this over to you, and you can start by telling us how you came to work for One School Global, what your experiences were like there, and what kind of changes you'd like to see happen within these schools from what you've experienced inside there. So go ahead.
Came to work at One School Global via a recruitment agency. So I had replied to a job position and I got a phone call from the recruiter, and right from the outset, I was aware that it wasn't sort of a normal situation. They kind of pre-warned me. So they gave me a spiel about it being a sort of fundamentalist Christian group, that they were quite conservative, so on and so forth. And from the outset, I kind of got the impression that they were almost masking. So, you know, like right from the very beginning, I felt like I needed to read between the lines.
So interesting you say that, because that is what I've heard from other teachers as well. That it made me want to, you know, Google actually what they were about, because it didn't sound like they were telling me the whole story. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it felt like a sort of a pre-warning, or a, you know, like you were being sort of molded to believe, or not believe, but, you know, being prepared for something. Mm-hmm. So I had an interview, and really the first red flag for me was that I was told I had to wear a skirt to the interview.
To the interview?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
So I was told you have to wear a skirt, they're very conservative, da-da-da-da-da. And for me that was, you know, I pretty much had ruled it out straight off. I went, oh, look, this is not for me. The first job I ever had, I had to, you know, as a very young person, had to say, you can't tell me I have to wear a skirt. And so it felt quite wrong that was the message. But then I thought, oh, you know, I'll go and check it out. It's a full-time position. It suited me in terms of location. And otherwise, the position seemed good. So I went to the interview. I mean, I think even before I walked in, one of the concerns that I had, given that I had been told that the kids couldn't go on to further study after high school, was that there was this potential for the school to be kind of a front for a school, because if you take away the opportunity to go to university, then the end years of high school are kind of irrelevant. You know, that the last 2 years of school in Australia are really directed towards attaining a score to get into university, pretty much.
So I just want to stop here for just a second. So they specifically told you up front that there's not post-secondary school.
Yes. Yeah. That was part of the spiel that I got before I even went to the interview.
What year did you start?
I think it was 2017.
So this is current. I just want to just pause here. to everybody, all of the PBCC spokesperson that deny this fact that we have a, and I mean, we know this from other teachers that we talk to, but it's just, I want to reiterate right now on this podcast that she just said that they told her at the interview that there was not post-secondary school. So they've starting to rebut this a bit because we're putting it out into the public's eye about this and they're denying it. So I just wanted to pause and reiterate this so that the listeners and especially the spokespersons for the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church can hear this.
Yeah, no, very definitely known fact that they couldn't continue on after.
And I think this is too, too, make sure you're aware, right, when you're teaching us, because I was obviously a student there as well, and I knew that we couldn't do university. I didn't know why. Obviously now in retrospect, you know, post leaving, I know why, because, you know, heaven forbid you start to have critical thinking towards your environment, right? So I know why. And it is really a waste. Those last 2 years were a waste. Like, I was a creative person in a normal world. My family should have harbored that and pushed me to creativity, like taking on creative subjects. I wanted to do art and I was told no. I've since met my art teacher since she left the school. And she said, remember when you tried to do art? I was told that I was told we weren't allowed to and with no reason. She was told we weren't allowed to because there could be a nude image or a nude sculpture in the final exam, HSC exam, and that is the reason why, because they couldn't have control over the material in the HSC exam. I said to her, you don't think I'd seen a nude image in year 12 and I wouldn't be hanging out for a HSC exam in a room full of people to look at a nude image? Like, it's just, it beggars belief, but this is the reality. And they often say, you know, that fact is stranger than fiction or reality is, because it is. Like, it's so sad to think that they're that delusional that those kids, all the kids in my class, we'd seen an image that was nude somewhere at one point in year 12, right? You're growing teens. There's other means of it, not a HSC exam. And in doing that, you've stunted somebody's opportunity to grow or their career, furthering their career. If they do choose to leave the Brethren, they really set you up for failure, because I have no accolades in terms of university degrees. Yes, I've been able to fulfill my career other ways, but I know kids that are studying psychology have found it really hard because there were elements to their learning that were disabled or handicapped because of the beliefs. And obviously it's setting you up so you can't succeed out here.
I mean, it goes against everything that teaching and education stands for. It's you know, we know that educated people are less inclined to be exposed to all sorts of terrible things. We know that it's empowering, particularly for women. So, you know, this idea that their education is stunted, and then it actually undermines their high school years anyway, because it is kind of pointless. So anyway, I went along to the interview. It was a little bit strange. And like I said, I'd pretty much already sort of, there were lots of red flags. I felt like it wasn't, I just had, you know, this inkling that it wasn't good. But there was a particular person in the interview who had a fabulous resume, who spoke amazingly, and that person was really the thing that changed it for me. And then it was also convenient for me at the time. At the time, I didn't have a full-time position. It presented an opportunity that I wasn't likely to get elsewhere, and I took a 12-month contract. So I thought, I'll do 12 months and then I'll sort of reassess. When I say reassess, I had no intention of staying. So I then had a second interview. For the second interview, again, I was asked to wear a skirt. And at that point I said, look, I've actually this is a bit of a problem for me because it goes against equal opportunity laws, and you know they're not allowed to ask me to do that. And at that point, they said, "Oh no, things have changed. You can actually wear pants now as a teacher." So once you're there, it's just for the meeting, because the second interview had Brethren members in it. I think in the first interview it had CAs, which are the campus administrators, so they're the Brethren representatives at the school. But for the second interview, there were more and more important people there. In that interview, there was, and the only way I could describe him is a creepy older man who came along and very quickly I realized the second interview wasn't about asking me questions or vetting me. It was about telling me what the expectations would be. So he told me then that I should turn up to work, that I shouldn't share anything about myself or my life, that they weren't interested in that. And that, you know, made it very clear that they didn't want me to have any influence over students or to build any kind of a personal relationship with students, which is clearly, you know, problematic as well. A good part of teaching is building
those relationships.
Exactly.
And obviously you're a professional, so you know that there are boundaries, right? But yeah. I understand it's important to teach somebody something. You have to have some sort of connection with them, otherwise it falls on deaf ears.
Yeah, that's it. So even, you know, just relating to life. So it was made very clear to me they didn't want me to talk about my children or about, you know, my home life, or not that you do really in depth, but there are times when you might refer to.
Yeah, I mean, an experience.
Yeah, exactly. So that was made very clear to me. It was a strange meeting because everyone is kind of really well behaved when there's an important person in the room. And I don't think workplaces, or certainly schools, are not like that anymore. They may have been a long time ago. But, you know, when you work in a school, you're working with peers, really. So even people who are in leadership, you know, there's this understanding that we're all educated to a certain level, and it's not like the boss is the end say. That's not really how schools work. They're usually more collaborative. Anyway, accepted the position, and then I think I started straight away. So I started in the middle of a term, and you know, from the moment I walked in the door, it was very clear that it wasn't like other schools that I had worked at. I think one of the, you know, I've been thinking about this, knowing that I was coming on. One of the things that I noticed straight away, I mean, there were some strange things, like at lunchtime we had a bell that sounded halfway through lunch, and that was for the kids to swap play areas. So for the first part of lunch, the boys would have the courts, and then for the second half of lunch, the girls would have the courts. So that was, you know, a bit strange. I don't think there's any school elsewhere where,
and that just to explain what that is, it's because the boys and the girls were not allowed to play together, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that was the same at my school as well, because I mean, I don't understand what you think is going to happen in a playground in the middle of daylight, but yeah.
When you mean courts, you mean like the playground, or is it
basketball courts?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't believe the girls actually got any time on the oval. But I think we didn't have a proper oval, but we had a grassed area. I don't think that they were privileged to even have time.
I was going to say, when I was at school from 2003 to 2009, I think it was, gosh, that's so long ago. The girls were allowed out the back. It was just the boys there at that point. I think there were times where they kind of pushed the boundaries and just played altogether, but it was definitely a boys and girls, although you got some boys were kind of allowed to intermingle and stay in that area where the volleyball courts were. So it was like I said, the boys got the fair share of the meal.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, in turn is setting them up for later on in life, right? Because that's
Yeah, that's nice. One of the things about that struck me really straight away is that they don't explain those things. They're quite secretive about them. So a lot of that stuff you kind of have to discern for yourself. And I have a very distinct memory, and I reckon it was probably in my first week of work, being on yard duty. So I'm out in the yard, and I believe I was probably taking over from the teacher and sort of asking her a question and getting the distinct impression that she was looking over her shoulder. So there was a lot of that went on the whole time I was there, being very careful what you said and where you said it. So, you know, whether that was not talking in front of students. And I mean, teachers clearly have conversations that are not appropriate to have in front of students. You might be talking about another student's learning or whatever. So that's not uncommon. But I've never been in a situation where people were nervous and kind of nervously checking who was listening. So there was this kind of really palpable sense of being watched or scrutinized and being worried about it. That's probably one of the things about working there that, you know, over time becomes more explicit and, you know, you have a better understanding of is just that constant idea that you could do the wrong thing or, you know, be reprimanded, so lose your job for something that you don't have a great deal of control over.
This is not an unfamiliar story, and I'm sharing this, and I know she won't mind me sharing it. So a teacher that I'm in touch with that, you know, was there in my earlier years of teaching, but only briefly, because in my first and second year, I think there was like a total of probably, I think, 9 teachers in the first year that were like flipped in that school. Wow. And that's a lot of uncertainty for somebody that's just starting high school. And I've been in contact with one of the teachers. She reached out and said, "Hey, I've seen your stuff. I have only just gotten to the point where I'm able to work in a work environment where I'm not in that flight or fight primal fear mode of like, is somebody, like, can I say, am I, you know, that just what you spoke about, looking over your shoulder." And like, we as ex-members experience that when we first leave, right? For the first couple of years, you're constantly like, is dad there? Is you know, somebody going to see me going into a cafe? Is somebody going to see me going to the movies? That like moves on, but she explained it to me. I was like, I know what you mean. I know what you feel like, because us members feel like that. And it's been also not just teachers. It was in the paper last weekend. Michael Batchelard and Lucy Macken reported on in the Sydney Morning Herald, where ex-members of UBT, the main headquarters of the Brethren that's undergoing a raid at the moment, there were ex-members from ex-workers from there that said the same thing. They the trauma goes with them, follows them on. Like, it's a traumatic experience to have you every moment micromanaged.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing. When I first arrived, I had come from a state school, and my very first observation was that the kids seemed to laugh more than other kids, which I soon discovered that there's kind of this veneer of innocence and then this really deep-seated anxiety. So the kids were also looking over their shoulders. They were also a little guarded about what they would say. I think that depending on the personality of the teacher, they would over time become more relaxed.
And you definitely did. You had your best friend teachers, you know, growing up as a closeted gay guy in there. And I know that, you know, there was another gay kid in my class who, and other years, like a couple of years above me, there were some more, like there were obvious gay kids, and you kind of clung onto a teacher that you sort of aligned yourself with or that you felt safe with, because you obviously, for me, I didn't feel that at home. And you do, there were kids that became more relaxed with certain teachers, and you then would say things to them. And sometimes I remember distinctly one teacher saying to me, you can't say that to me. I don't want to hear that. Like, and I know it was about a boundary over how I felt about either me or my changing body or growing up, or and it's within that community that probably alarms them that did you ever find or experience that? That a child sort of gets close to you or explains something to you that you know you can't be hearing?
I was very afraid of being in that situation the whole time I was there, because you're being pulled in two directions. You have your responsibility as a teacher and duty of care, and then you have a responsibility to, I guess, support or hold up brethren values. And those two things are often in conflict.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
And I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, for example, in the Sydney school, there was a kid that was being abused. They reported it, but they know that the reporting system stays within the brethren hierarchy. So then their teacher duty of care is like, no, I need to report this to the police because this is not being taken care of. So it's like a tug of war between, like you said, the duty of care and maintaining brethren values. But you, like you said previously too, and I like to draw back to, often the school comes across, and in my belief, is just a veneer for a bigger, wider project. And as we're sort of uncovering in the, with the Sydney Morning Herald, it's a business. It's a cult. Yeah. Education of these students is not paramount, because that's why they don't further the education. Because if they did, they wouldn't have, and there's a reason why they call us, used to call us young kids, the potential, because they, I believe they have the potential to maintain the cult, or the potential to break away and break down the cult. Because if they didn't have kids, they didn't have the indoctrination, they wouldn't have the cult.
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting thing. Towards the end of my time there, one of the leaders within the school, so a non-brethren person, articulated to me that there is a very specific program, system that they use. I guess because I'm female and I can identify with the girls, I often really thought about things from their perspective. But this person articulated to me that they very strategically set up boys to be stuck. So once they leave school, they get given jobs that they are paid very well for, that they wouldn't be paid nearly that much if they were out in the world with their level of education. They're encouraged to get a home loan. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Encouraged to get a home loan straight away so that they're stuck. They're stuck in the system. And it was really clearly articulated to me that's because the boys are at risk of leaving. Because when they're young, you know, the outside world is tempting, I guess. It looks like it's exciting, that idea of freedom, and, you know, young men in boys particularly, there's stages in development where they're separating from family or from parents, and you know, risk-taking and independence are part of a normal, I mean, for any kid, but, you know, particularly boys, that's part of what they do. So, you know, things like that, over the years, hearing more and more of those things, it's just horrifying to me, because, you know, you have a kid in, say, year 8 or 9 who's already realised there's no point in being at school. So you've got a young man who's there, he's bored. Where does that lead? It kind of leads to depression. So they're at school every day, really disengaged, not wanting to be there. And you know that that's kind of, that's their future, because as soon as they leave school, they're sort of trapped in a different way. Very unsatisfying to, and I mean, look, you know, on the other hand, these kids deserve to be, like, one of the things that I think keeps the good teachers is that they are owed an education just like anyone. And now you're making me cry, Ben.
I didn't mean to, it really hit home to me, just to cut back to what you just said about being depressed at school. I was so depressed at that school growing up, and I didn't, like, hearing you say it sort of puts it in perspective. That's what it was. Like, the lights in that school were not coming to school each day. It was seeing, you know, certain teachers that I could get whispers of freedom, or whispers of an insight to an outside world. And I remember, I'd come home, I'd go to my bedroom, and I would lay on my bed, and cry myself to sleep kind of thing. My mum would come in like, why haven't you done any work? Wait, like, go and have a shower. It's time to get ready for the meeting. I'd go and sit in the shower and cry. And then I'd go to church, come back to school the next day. Because those school environments were so toxic. There were a bus ride to school that was just with brethren kids. And if you were beaten in that bus ride, you were beaten at school. You were beaten on the way home from school. You were beaten at church. Because it's the same environment. It's the same kids. It's the same people that you're seeing. The only light in those 6-7 years of high school or primary school to high school are the teachers, are the outside world. And yeah, it hit close to home when you were speaking about that, because I'm like, that was they were the worst years of my life.
No, that's horrifying. That was my greatest fear, was to be in a position where you're confronted with it all the time, but actually finding myself have a student say something to me where I had this conflict of my duty of care, and because there's no good solution. I mean, the other thing is, because there were lots of great things about the school, and for the most part, I really enjoyed my time. It's unique in that you're teaching kids the whole way through. So you get to know the kids really well. You get to know the families. The families are involved in a way that other, you know, secondary schools don't really involve families in that kind of way. So you get to know families, you know, the younger siblings, you know, all of their cousins. I mean, I had a class where there were like five or six first cousins, and that's unheard of anywhere else. And family is everything. So to be faced with a situation where the solution, to meet your duty of care is actually going to jeopardize the safety of this kid is horrifying. So that you can't, I mean, I, like you said, Ben, we had students who, and you never want to make assumptions, but it seemed fairly clear that they were questioning their sexuality, if not, you know, fairly certain that they're gay. You know, what good outcome is there from that? Because to leave is so painful and so devastating.
Yeah. And Jane, like, leaving wasn't an option. It was like, it wasn't something I considered until I had started working. And I think I want to draw back to the reference to where you spoke about they were more worried about the boys leaving than the girls. Well, that's because they've set up, and I explain why I think that, because they've set up a system, right, to, it is essentially a system where women are oppressed. So there's no chance of the girls getting financial stability, getting a career, getting a taste of it, because they don't progress. They go straight to work, and it's usually for their father's business, and it's always mundane office jobs, the serving position. And from there, they are immediately like married off. So they don't stay in the workforce long enough to get a taste for a career. And then what they do in the workforce, they hate so much, they'd rather be a housewife and a mum. So essentially, they don't have to worry about them because there's a system in place for the girls. But it's the boys, because when you do get your first paycheck, then leaving was an option for me. So prior to that, at school, leaving wasn't an option. It was suicide. It was pretending to be straight. And what I'd heard, the chemical castration drugs. So they were the three options. And I know a former student of MET Sydney, he's also gay. He told me last month, he said, and it was something I didn't tell him. He told me, and I'm like, these are the same three options I thought of through his whole school life. It was pretending to be a straight, marrying a woman. He said, they offered me chemical castration, or they said, kill yourself. So he said, I didn't know about leaving until I got my first pay packet. I'm like, me too. That's when you got the confidence to know that, hang on, I can probably get out of this place. Like, that's another option. I just wanted to cover that topic because you spoke about the girls not being a threat. I'm like, yes, that's so correct, because there's a genius system in place to make sure that they never, ever think like that.
Yeah. I think too, very early on, I noticed, because there are some challenges in educating kids who have this inherent lack of respect for education. And sometimes I wonder whether I've kind of just made an assumption, but over the years, the distinct impression that you get is that they have this idea that they don't need to go to university, that worldly people go to university because they're kind of stupid, that the brethren themselves are too clever.
And the irony in that, yeah. The absolute irony.
Yeah.
It's like the Emperor's New Clothes story, right?
Yeah. So it was palpable, particularly with the girls. I reckon it happened somewhere between term one and term three. You could see the realization that this was their last shred of freedom, because the truth is when they're at school, they're not actually with, I mean, other than their peers, the teachers, the staff, for the most part, are not brethren. So they have this kind of moment of freedom where they know that the teachers don't really understand a lot of what goes on, because there's sort of that secrecy around why they do things. But you could feel them, and they'd go a little bit crazy. And this might be an assumption, but I'm fairly certain that the women are quite controlled always, in that somebody always knows exactly where they are. So that they don't get the freedom to kind of wander off and do their own thing at any point. And this is really an assumption, but observationally, I'm not sure that the women were encouraged to congregate. So I sort of, when I first started, I had this idea that, you know, it was this beautiful family thing, and that the women would all get together with their babies outside of school. But I think they're actually kept pretty busy doing their own thing, and there is a bit of a discouragement for big groups to get together. Is that correct?
Yes. And it's a specific thing in there, like back before they have things in place to stop that now. And like not that it's a mandatory written rule, but there were things like partisan activities was always brought up. If you had like parties or what was familiar friends, and that was, there was no special friendships in the brethren. We love all the brethren. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, he raped your cousin, well, that's fine because the Lord forgive him and so should you, but you've got to have him over, you know, you've got to, that's the mindset in there for the grassroots bottom end of the echelon within that society. Obviously The higher up ones, they will only have who they want around for dinner. And I know that because I've been in both ends. I grew up in the bottom end and witnessed the top end before I left. And there were partisan activities. There were special friendships. We wouldn't associate with them. And it's a kind of like Animal Farm all over again. You know, all animals are equal, but some are just more equal than others. And now they have things like Campus & Co, which is like the school shops. And that was just sort of starting when I was leaving. So The women become so involved in that. All free labor, of course. That's why they had to rewrite their Modern Slavery Act. But that's what keeps them occupied. So they can't gather together. They can't, you know, prisoners band together and go, well, hang on, this is a bit of a shit situation. How do we get out? There's none of that because, well, I don't even think the women have, I shouldn't say all, because of the six women that I've helped leave or had something to do with, in leaving, they're brilliant people, you know, like, and they couldn't be brainwashed. They were like, this is a cult. We have to get out of this. But generally speaking, like my mom, I feel sorry for them. They haven't got a skerrick of a thought of their own. You know, it's everything she says is just, you've heard that spat out by dad or the church, you know, it's nothing new.
You know, I don't know if anybody's seen, I mean, most people have seen the documentary on the FLDS called Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey. And we get, I often relate how that movie, that documentary is very, very similar to the PBCC. Even though the women are not in these men's beds, these women belong to these men. Right. Yeah. We're seeing right now there's this influx of men leaving right now. They're leaving their wives, leaving behind kids because they see through it, because they get put into these positions of providing. They get put in these positions. They just see things differently than the females do. The females, unless unless you're having a lot of, you've had a lot of abuse happen to you, you've had a lot of precivitis, a lot of like things happen to you, it's hard for you to see through the veneer of groveling, and you're looking at these men of God or these priests that are put into place of authority, and you know that your authority belongs, yourself belongs to them. It doesn't belong to your husband. It doesn't belong
there.
That's
how they explain away things like marital rape and other things that do happen in there. They're like, well, you know, you're my property. And yes. This is, we've heard this from other survivors that have come forward and told their stories. It was like, he owned me. Like, it's...
So you are right in what you're seeing, where you're seeing that the women don't have as much freedom, so to speak, as the men do, because the men, yeah. The men and the boys get away with more.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's funny that you mentioned when you were talking just then, Ben, about special friendships. Sorry, that's probably not the best wording, but you know what I mean. Individual.
That's what they call it in there, though.
That's what they call it. So. Brethren jargon, did you ever like, in your first, sorry to digress, but on the like first week of your employment in the Brethren community, were you like, what is a meeting? What is a break? What is a, like all these jargon that they use? Did you find
actually,
that?
One of the things that I thought when I first started, one of the things I noticed was the accent. So,
yes.
And as I was there for a bit longer, I didn't notice it so much. But when I first started, they asked me if I was English and thought that I was very posh, which I'm not.
I just don't speak the crass. Have you, did you notice it in particular with the girls? It's more the girls that talk like that. We had the break, hey? And it was like,
it sounds
they have a
like,
real... Brawl.
Yeah, they do, a real twang. If you watch any news footage of Australia from like the 60s,
yes.
It sounds like it's like stepping back in time. It's really distinct, because I taught at a school in the suburbs. So, you know, it's not like I was teaching in the outback of Australia where you might expect to be presented with that stuff. I did notice the accent straight away. And then also not so much in their spoken language, but in written language, they would use there'd be this kind of formal language of, where is this coming from? And somebody explained to me that they when I started, that only just started having access to more books and the internet.
Yeah.
So a lot of the language was actually taken from the Bible. Which is don't normally find that in high school essay. You don't find Bible language. And then also, I mean, I'm without being rude, as an outsider, I would say a bastardized Bible, because it's kind of reinterpreted.
It's not the original anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. So,
heavens, you wouldn't have wanted to have said that in there. But it's funny you say that, and just to relate to the whole terminology thing. So I wrote in English creative writing, I used to love, and I'd get into it. And I remember writing about this person. Like, I think we had to rewrite Lady Macbeth's story, but modernize it. And I used the word impotent, which I didn't realize what it meant today. And in terms of a sexual way, like it hit non-functioning kind of thing, but I didn't realize that. And so I remember here, my English teacher, she came to me and said after class, can you say that for a second? She said, what do you mean by this word? And I was like, well, in the Bible, he was impotent on his feet. He couldn't walk. And she's like, oh. And she's like laughing. And she's like, oh, my God. And I was just like, innocent little me. I was like, I want to use the big word in this, you know.
I mean, that was one of the funny things. This very formal use of language.
Friendships. We were talking about special friendships.
I think I did notice that straight up. So in a normal high school situation, you would find kids, both male and female, would have like a best friend. That's not the case, and it's very much discouraged. And I remember over the years there were a couple of instances where, you know, two girls would kind of form a tight friendship, and they would be discouraged from hanging around together, and they'd get a lot of grief from their peers, from You know, we would get a message to say, don't let them sit together. Those two need to be separated. It's not healthy. You know, and so they would be kind of guarded about it as well. They'd be trying to get through the day without drawing attention to themselves. There's a lot of controlling things that, you know, in a normal situation, you just kind of let play out.
And did you find that even if they were related, like if there was if they were cousins?
I feel like yeah. And you know, I sort of had this idea that they would get together on the week, you'd have sleepovers and da-da-da-da-da. Over the time, I became more of aware of the fact that, you know, that, look, I think it kind of comes down to the fact that you're really discouraged from being an individual. So in a normal high school setting, you know, teenagers can be a little introspective. It's a time of discovering who you are and what you believe in and trying out different things and doing all of that stuff. So in terms of motivation and engagement, there are certain things that in a normal, no, I don't want to say normal, that's unfair, but in another school situation would be things that kids would be really interested in doing. So looking within themselves, you know, expressing their personal opinions, blah, blah, blah. I very quickly realized that the Brethren kids were very uncomfortable doing that, that it was discouraged. And you become aware that, like, you are discouraged from being an individual. Being an individual is kind of threatening to the whole, the group.
Yeah.
And that you know, has implications for curriculum and,
And there's the whole special friendship thing too, is like just from a kid at the school's perspective, I was too afraid to, because you grew up not trusting anybody. And that works perfectly for a cult, a toxic cult environment, because if you don't trust anybody, and even in your own family, right, because you're always looking out over your shoulder because you're going to get in trouble for doing something wrong, for breathing out of line or having an impure thought even, like, you don't trust anybody, because the moment you do, usually that person's like guilty conscience, the psychological warfare that you have going on constantly while you're in there, caves, and then you report, and then that person is immediately in trouble. So you don't trust anybody. And that's why from an early age, it's kind of inherently inbred into you that you're like that primal fear of not trusting. There's no pack mentality at all, because it's everyone for themselves.
Yeah. And I think that sort of goes back to, you know, when I said I first arrived, I sort of had this general observation that the kids sort of laughed and seemed a little more lighthearted. Very quickly realized that wasn't
just a nervous reaction.
you know, on the surface, they didn't have access to social media, so they didn't, and they're very uncomfortable with, you know, looking at themselves or doing that stuff. So as a superficial observation, that appeared to be a freedom, as in they seemed less self-conscious than other teenagers. But I really quickly started to notice this disturbing and disproportionate threat of anxiety. So there were kids that had really significant anxiety disorders. Like, you know, a young man, a 14-year-old boy who is essentially anorexic, he's not eating, constantly nauseated, fainting, can't do any exercise. And there was no physical problem with this kid, seemed very obvious to me, not that I'm a doctor, but, you know, just this really distinct threat of anxiety, which I hadn't experienced really. I mean, kids are anxious and, you know, have this stuff, but this was kind of grave.
Wow.
Yeah. And there were like one in every school. There was one in our school, a girl, and there were, I know that there's been multiple across the board. And you even have to the point where kids that show signs of deep emotional disturbance usually either light fires or harm animals, right? And there were that was rife with me growing up with the kids around me. Like if I wasn't subject to bullying, it was the birds they were catching and the wings they were cutting off. It was the kittens they were putting on the back of hot trays. It was the rabbits they were tying fireworks to. It was that or me, you know, and I know that that wasn't just my school. It wasn't my campus. I wasn't singularly the only kid and random person it's happened to, because, well, that's the beauty of social media now. So many people can connect and share their stories. I'm like, that's not dissimilar to what I experienced or I've heard. And it is, it's rife within there, this whole line. And I think my point I want to make too is that those kids that come forward and have obvious signs like anorexia, or have obvious signs that they're battling mentally with their mental health, they're not given the help they're needing. Like, they are told that you're mental and that's what you're branded as. And if your mom or it's usually the women, your mom showed any signs of being slightly not capacitated to take on have the breaks regularly, or have like this, their lifestyle is very full on. You have to entertain continually, you have to constantly have your house in order. And yeah. So it's a lot of pressure, not only financially, but physically and emotionally and mentally for the women. So you have women that can't keep up with it and break down, and they're just like deemed as mental. And then the girls or the kids that come from those families are called the same thing. There's no underlying, like, there's no sympathy for kids in that situation. It's just deemed as mental.
Jane, yeah. What would happen if you were to report something like that? Did you ever have to report anything that you witnessed?
So the way that mandatory reporting works, you know, there's a whole lot of things that you're kind of educated to see as red flags and reasons for reporting. I did have an occasion where I had a student who repeatedly turning up with injuries, and it was quite a difficult situation in that the particular student's father was a CA.
Yeah.
So that is a
conflict of interest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So I was with another teacher, the form group teacher or the home group teacher, I can't remember what we call them, like pastoral care. Definitely didn't call it pastoral care. That got changed. Academic care, maybe. Anyway, the home group teacher. And this kid kept turning up with injuries. He came at one point with a black eye, and this comes back to, you know, what you said earlier about hearing something you didn't want to hear. I think that in retrospect, so I unconsciously said, oh, what happened? You know, are you okay? And then probably instantly wished I hadn't asked, because yeah. Hearing anything might put me in a position. And so
you have to act. Yeah.
Yeah. He described that he had given himself a black eye by pulling his sheet up in bed a little vigorously, which is clearly, I mean, that.
Yeah, you know, that's just like a cover. That yeah. Could have happened.
Yeah. Given that there was a, you know, that I'd noticed, I think I spoke to my co-form teacher, who was somebody who really chose to have their head in the sand, so that you know, there wasn't even a discussion. And then I reported
it. Often on that note, the people that do have their head in the sand, it's because they've witnessed something. So I know that for a fact, because a former teacher has spoken to me and apologized and said, look, I had my head in the sand because I didn't know how to deal with this.
Yeah, look, I mean, teachers have lives, so, you know, we're all there for different reasons. We've all got different stuff going on at home. And I definitely don't want to kind of throw shade on anyone, but I think the schools attract a certain kind of person, because, you know, for me, it got to a point where I looked around and I thought, anyone that I respect and think is a good teacher and a good person leaves.
This is exactly right. A teacher sent me a message saying early on, like last year when I started talking about it, and said she came to the conclusion that the only people that could work there and last there with longevity were either people that had the same ideals, so they were either sexist, ageist, homophobic, or I can't remember the other one, but yeah. There was a list of things that she ran through and she said...
I think that might have been me, actually. I think so, yeah. And so it's like either they're innocent in that they don't see a problem with it, they actually, their values align, or they don't care. Neither of them.
But then that might begs the question for me, why are you in a job that has its sole responsibility is the education of children, is the safety, is the harbouring, the nurturing of children? Don't take up a job that involves that. That's the first, the priority in your job, right, is the care of children.
Yeah. I mean, look, I guess there's a reason why they have to put into law this duty of care, and that is that not everyone innately feels that responsibility. Yeah. They have to make it explicit to some people.
Do you know if they had a safeguarding policy in place?
In what sense?
When it comes to spotting sexual abuse?
Well, it's law. So teachers have a duty of care. We're personally responsible. We do training, which we upgrade yearly. So every year we have to kind of tick over updating our understanding of child safety and duty of care. I mean, the insidious thing about the Brethren is that you feel like you're constantly in this position of threat, and you're worried about doing the wrong thing, and it's, I think it is often impossible to meet your duty of care and satisfy the Brethren. You know, a lot of it is for show. So a couple of examples of things that happened over the years. I was still there at the beginning of COVID. So we were, you know, in Australia, lots of the states had extended periods of home learning. We were in a period of home learning. I think maybe we were kind of at an in-between point where we were back on campus. And an email was sent out to teachers referring to the fact that a student had accessed the kids' helpline on their school computer. And so the gist of the email was, is there any educational reason that that child has accessed that website? And if not, then it was an ICT breach and that kid would be reprimanded for using their computer to do something against the school rules. Now, you know, that to me...
So just help me understand this. Why would a kid reach out to a kid's helpline?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, then be reprimanded for it. That's awful.
Yeah. And you know,
you're saying that the kid's helpline is for kids that are like, if I was suicidal at high school, which I was, like I had those thoughts, I would reach out to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my assumption is that within the community, the expectation is that you would reach within for help.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to navigate the helpline is for. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing that's disturbing, because the email was sent by and to people who are not Brethren and who for whom that should have been very obviously a massive red flag. That kind of plays into that idea that I spent the whole time, in the end, I was very afraid of something happening where I was put in that position where a kid said something to me. And so that's awful, because you do, you know, I have children. I, at the very least, expect their teachers to meet their duty of care, their legal obligation, and I don't think that's always the case. So certainly in that instance, you know, here's a kid who is stuck at home for an extended period of time with no access to anyone else. We didn't get, like, I feel like obviously there are privacy laws that limit the sharing of information, but I think at other schools there is there's an effort to make sure that teachers are aware if there's something going on at home. And that might not be specific details, but, you know, a child will be flagged and you'll be keeping an eye on stuff. That didn't happen. I believe that this particular student, it was known that there was some issue, but they were stuck at home and they've accessed this kids' helpline, which is clearly a cry for help. And it was interpreted as a breach of ICT. So
this is the issue I have with all of this is it's turned around and said, how dare you, to the child, most likely. This is against Mr. Hales. This is against the fellowship. And then they turn around and say, we don't know why you call us a cult. Like, look at your behaviours. Look at what happens when a child is reaching out for help. I've been in a similar situation. It's so, so disturbing.
It's so hard not to let my emotions override this one. This is heart-wrenching. It's absolutely heart-wrenching to know that a child knew enough to reach out to a helpline and then gets reprimanded for it.
Yeah.
Between you and the teachers that you know, when things were reported, what happened with you and your peers if things were reported to CAs that were brethren members of the children that were there? Do you have any experiences where the process was halted due to conflict of interest?
So I don't have any personal experience because I was just a teacher. We didn't, depending on who the CA was, but we didn't really have a great deal to do with them. And the first point of call would be to go to leadership within the school. I am aware of a leader who, so the school that I was at, there was a family where it was very openly known that the father was an alcoholic and abusive. So these kids are living in a situation of domestic violence. The mother periodically reached out to, and, you know, kind of unfortunate, but I feel like because of the way the system works within the brethren, rather than reach out to a female, this woman would reach out to a male teacher, which then creates, other sort of issues.
Mm-hmm.
But reaching out for help, the kids would not have uniform, they'd never have lunch, and it was always put onto the mum. You know, she's hysterical, she can't cope,
living with an abusive alcoholic.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the thing, they always put it back on the woman. And the same with my school. There was a kid in my class that we all knew he had an abusive, a family environment that was abusive. And so in turn, you know, like that behavior is learned. If there's nothing, no help, actual help provided, that behavior is learned. And then, today we have the same situation where I hear recently that his wife was in mental health hospital because of domestic violence. So the same thing, cycle after generation after generation.
Maybe he couldn't help her because she wasn't providing the home life that he needed to support. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's really defective. So I know that this is, I guess, kind of hearsay in that I'm not talking about myself, but that person, that leader, did report and they received lots of grief about that.
Yeah.
The leader, as in the non-brethren, like the teacher?
And had a short-lived career.
And we find that lots. Yeah. Let's go into this whole disappearing. How many teachers were disappeared while you were there? When did you quit? You were there from 2017 till when?
2021.
And was there a lot of teachers that would just disappear overnight? Let's talk about that because
One of the things that I became really aware of while I was there is there's this pressure to do things that don't meet duty of care. And they can be really simple things like not supervising properly, allowing kids access to rooms that they shouldn't have access to. But you only need to see it happen a couple of times where a child is injured or something happens in that situation where you are really being pressured to allow them to do whatever. So it's like the school is running in a fashion where we're not meeting our proper duty of care. When I arrived, most of the teachers didn't really understand what their duty of care was, which was quite foreign to me. But as soon as something goes wrong, it would be put back on the teacher and then that person would disappear. So, for instance, if a child accessed your computer outside of your permission, so it's not like I've given a kid my computer to use. They've, while my back is turned, gone to my computer because the teachers have access to a little more than students. Yeah, I think. If they see something, the teacher gets disappeared. I think at one point my colleagues and I kind of calculated turnover, and not all because teachers left, not all because teachers were invited to leave, but sometimes just because, you know, people very quick, it becomes very obvious straight away whether someone's going to survive for any length of time or whether they're out the door straight away. But there was a turnover of well over 40%, which is really high.
Yeah. Ed, you have a different number now lately, right? Hey?
I was going to say, just to add to that, on that note, so I've got a list of things that sort of accumulated or people have DM'd me. So somebody that is well-connected in the Sydney school has reached out and said, Sydney school has had a 70%, and I quote, staff turnover in the last year. And an interesting thing is that I think they've got NESA reviews. Is it NESA? Is that who reviews the private schools?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Is it NESA the...
I think that they're state-based. So it may be...
NESA.
So there are bodies that... you're talking about like school accreditation. Yeah, they're state-based. Probably is NESA in New South Wales.
Yeah, I think, So I think they're up for review next year, and they will have to explain that. They have to explain why they've had such a high turnover of staff, and it would just be interesting to know how they'll go about doing that. So this is just the Sydney school.
The teacher shortage is well known across Australia.
I think it does come down to a lot of the research that teachers do prior, because there was another teacher that reached out to me. She said, hey, I'm a teacher that landed a job at Sydney last year, real recently. And she said that actually saw your TikToks and then the podcast crew and was like, no, these red flags that I saw in the interviews, like you said, I was like, no way.
I mean, look, that's one of the things. When I took the job, I was really worried I'd get stuck there because it's not a proper school. I mean, that's just call an apple an apple. That was my suspicion. And then I wasn't there for very long. So, but the whole time I was there, it was like weighing up, are we really educating kids, or is this kind of something else?
A placeholder for something else. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in the end, I mean, I still am undecided, and I think one of the things about leaving is that there was a period of, it's like leaving a dysfunctional relationship, you know, there's a period of having to kind of work through everything that happened. There's an element of guilt involved in working in a situation where you feel like you can see things going on that aren't right. And I mean, you know, even something as simple as by teaching in that system, I'm condoning the beliefs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have a problem with people having different beliefs to myself. But that's not how the brethren see things. And so after a while, you go, well, actually, I'm not allowing someone to have a different belief than mine. I'm actually perpetuating what I see as dysfunctional behavior. So, you know, I'm implicit in allowing this to happen. So, you know, that's kind of where I ended up, and a good part of the reason there were lots of reasons for leaving. But I still have had sleepless nights worrying, did I make the right decision? Did I, whatever else? But in terms of teachers disappearing, I remember one year, at the end of the year, we had like a, you know, what you would call a speech night, a day where the year 12s get to graduate, or the final year students get to graduate. And usually there's a bit of celebration, so there'll be some sort of singing and performing, whatever it is. And this, they used to always get a kid up to give a speech, always a boy, and it would be kind of like a roast. So they have a really kind of nasty humor sometimes, really unrelenting. And that's when they would shamelessly, you know, call a kid out for being overweight, call a kid out for like this. So that is disturbing in itself. But this particular year, this kid got up and listed, and it was a long list, listed the teachers that they'd gotten rid of and the ways that they'd done it. And at the time we had, so the school that I was at went through a period of, I think it's, this is really common, a period of instability in terms of leadership, in that they couldn't keep a principal. They couldn't find someone who, you know, didn't.
That was common. That happened with us.
Yeah, because, you know, really the buck stops with that person. So I was a little protected in the sense that unless it was a situation that was, you know, not a question mark, but a very clear problem, I didn't have to mandatory report. I would report to the next person up, and that person would. So my duty of care is to follow the school's reporting process. So yeah, that was super disturbing and not something that you would find in a normal school, like this very open and, you know, where there was a room full of family laughing away at these people whose careers had been marred in some way or another by, you know, kids deciding that for whatever reason they weren't.
And I had a recent leaver of like teacher reach out to me and say to me, it's already a risk you taking on this career choice and having it on your resume. It's already a risk because in the real world, you know, you're already behind, like actual employees of other schools will already know you're behind in advanced, like things like technology or literature. Like you're stepping back into a very restricted time capsule almost of a school that doesn't further your career, it doesn't give you credibility other than resilience, that you're a resilient teacher who can work in extreme environments, correct? Like in the sense of dealing with personalities and the leadership that run the school. Like there's no benefit to your career, she said. In some ways it's jeopardizing because at the end of the day, the people, your next employers, because obviously she's gone out, found a new career, like new job still within teaching, but they were like, why did you work there? Like, why did you stay in that environment? And how do you explain this career choice? Like, we want the best for our kids. How do you explain, like, did you agree with those values? Did you, like, what made you stay there? And because there's no benefit, there's nothing that adds to your resume. She's just finding this out now. And she's like, it's a thing I didn't think of.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things when I started, you know, I had this big question mark over how it could be a real school, whether there was really this kind of motivation to educate. And I don't think it was ever actually articulated to me, but the impression that I got, I feel like I was led to believe that they were going through a transition. So the genesis of the school, I think, is that originally kids were being homeschooled, often by people who weren't schooled very well themselves, so that's clearly problematic.
They did a lot of distant education, like my auntie's like age group, they did distant education, but that obviously the kids weren't doing the schoolwork. And
So the school started off quite small and I think fairly unruly, as in the kids kind of behaved in ways that other school kids don't really behave, a bit loose. And so my understanding was that they were moving towards, it was kind of like this reforming of the school, trying to make it whatever. And there did definitely a veneer of that. So, I mean, one of the strange things that happens, I mean, there's so much to talk about.
It's okay. We have lots of time.
is this marketing of the school. So we used to have groups of people that were bought through. When I started off, I was at a very tiny campus, and then I ended up at one of the bigger, newer campuses. And we'd have people coming through, showing them how the school was set up and the technology. And there's like this big sales pitch about how amazing it is and whatever else. My experience, my understanding was that that was very much a veneer, and you know, you can have all the technology in the world, but unless you're actually using it properly.
Who were they showing this to? Like, who were they? Was it other?
There were university groups, other schools that moved towards that kind of stuff. All sorts of people. Like, I think at one point we had some politicians come through.
Of course. And it's like, that's where you, like, alarm bells would be ringing, right? Like, it's almost like North Korea when you go and visit. You've got like a whole charade of actors playing this happy normal life, and you cannot deviate from that path. Right? It's the oldest trick in the book.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable and not really how teaching is. So I remember, you know, they'd identify teachers that they sort of felt were doing good stuff. And because, like I said to you, you know, we did have some great teachers. Usually they didn't stay very long because it's inherently unsatisfying to work in an environment where you quickly kind of realize that it's not student-centered and it's not really about educating. So there'd be this kind of sales pitch. They'd bring people through that what they wanted to see is that you know, were using Zoom in a collaborative kind of way. Maybe you've got some extra stuff going on, like an extra camera. Maybe you're doing something practical in a science class or whatever. You know, they wanted
you're using a microwave because you know, it's a common misunderstanding that brethren don't have microwaves because they look like a TV.
Actually,
like it's them trying to you know, myth bust essentially, because they're trying to repair the image of themselves in the real world.
I know too, you know, they have the So as part of teaching, in order to maintain registration, you have to do sort of training all the time. And so you do professional development. The Brethren have the Teacher Academy, which does its in-house professional development, which is, you know, directed towards it. It's all about sustaining itself and providing itself with business. So the schools are constantly upgrading, which seems amazing. You think, oh, you know, they're really investing in this education and this institution. But you quickly sort of discover that they do strange things like, you know, setting up a kitchen for a home economics class or, you know, food studies, whatever it's called. And there's no consultation with either, you know, architectural groups that are familiar with schools or the teachers. And so they set up a kitchen that's got amazing stuff in it, but doesn't allow you to supervise properly. So they'll put, you know, a room, you have to walk through two rooms to go and get the food or to go and get something. And in that period of time, you've got 12 kids in a kitchen with fire and heat and unsupervised. You kind of realize, and then you go, hang on a second, the people that are installing this stuff, they're all Brethren businesses.
That's right. I was going to say, and then the penny drops, right? And we've done just done previous podcasts about this that Cheryl's crew have done, where it highlights that a lot of this is for a bigger picture organization. Yeah. And I have said multiple times that I believe it's all interconnected, and the school is anything but a school.
For me, when I look at it, it's a babysitting program for them to funnel money through, right? Yeah, it gives them it's very, really, very brilliant. Very brilliant plan at the expense of their future generations, which I mean,
and at the expense of the grassroots families that, like yours, Cheryl, and mine, that have to, you know, continually send money to the school because, well, we're upgrading for your children.
So we have a list of like books that are not allowed in these schools. I'm sure you came, they gave you stuff that you're not allowed to teach from this, you're not allowed to teach from that. What did you have one of those?
So very, very definitely had to be really careful. I was like, you know what? The thing is, there's this, it's everything is a veneer. So there's this, this outward suggestion that everything is very controlled. And if you want to show a video, you have to get it approved and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is the process isn't set up. So if you were to wait for approval, you'd never show them anything. So mostly it actually came down to your ability to find appropriate materials and show them and make sure that you didn't show something inappropriate. I remember when I started, I was in the staff room and I noticed a teacher with a big black marker blacking out sections of a textbook, so, and then pulling out pages. So they do get the textbooks printed, particularly for science or, you know, I think maybe, I don't know what you call it, PE or health studies, where there's anything that is looking at
any development. Diagram of the human body, essentially. Yeah. That's what I remember. Because they'd be stuck together back in my day and you'd just peel them open.
Yeah. So they would, you know, that person was editing a textbook because they'd ordered however many copies and ended up with one not enough. I did have a situation once where I had one of my year 12 students who was in a Zoom class from another campus, so they're not in the room with me, get up and leave. And I'm like, what's going on? Why has he left? It was because I'd created this PowerPoint and I'd used an image as a background, and it was really innocuous. I think it was like a period in history, and it was just a line drawing of something. And in the background, it had what was essentially a stick figure. So it was like not a stick figure. It was like an outline of a person.
Like a silhouette.
Yes, sort of. You could see the shape of their bottom. And so this kid had gotten up and left because he was disgusted that I'd shown this obscene image. I remember being quite paranoid that I was going to get in trouble for that. You know, you definitely had to be very careful. Like subjects like history and English, you would be really careful what you show them or what they read, concepts that you know, you might not even know, because they're not open. It's very secretive.
Your opinion too, right? Like your opinion was very stuck. And that incident reminds you of something that as a child growing up in there, I was in year seven and we had a teacher that was expressed her view. It was her first year working, and she expressed her view of her disdain for what George Bush did going into Iraq and Middle East, right? Yep. Growing up in there, you were pro George Bush, you were pro John Howard, you were pro everything that was right-wing Christian, everything that was like suited and that we heard from our parents. So when she mentioned something about that, like, I remember my instinct was to arc up and protect. And I'm so ashamed of it now because I have the very opposite view to what I did back then, right? But I remember just lashing out on this poor teacher. And I remember her fear of being like, holy shit, I have said something here that you know, I just saw the cogs turning. And I instantly regretted it, thinking, oh my God, this poor woman is like terrified, because she was like straight away confronted with a child that was like, this is a conflict of our what we believe in, and if you're not aligned with that, then maybe you shouldn't be teaching here. And it was a very, like, I regret doing that. Interesting turn of events with that particular teacher. She climbed her way all the way to the top and would have witnessed so much. And like, it's really, really disappointing for me, for somebody like that. And I get it, you've got kids, you've got a family to provide for, but at the end of the day, you have children. And you know what us kids went through. You know what kids went through in terms of abuses that you would have seen, because you were at the top, you witnessed a lot and you hit a lot. And then we all knew, we all said, she's climbing too close to the top. She's trying to be a brethren. She'll get kicked out. And sure enough, she was disappeared, because she was right up in, like, at One School Global head office. She ended up there. She ended up quite high up. And then she was just disappeared. And sure enough, like, everybody knows that she was given a brilliant pay packet and to keep quiet. And we all knew that inside. And obviously everyone else outside knew that as well now, because that's what happens when teachers disappear and don't say a word. You know that they've got some pretty healthy money sent their way. Mm-hmm. And it's just so disappointing, so disappointing. You could be stopping a generation of a cult could be stopped, and you have the power to help that. Like, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back, right?
Yeah, it's the money. I hate that money still talks in this world the way it does. Jane, did you find that certain students had power over you? Like, did you, we've had other teachers come on and talk. What was that?
Yeah.
Oh, is it based on family name?
Yeah. Like, what was the hierarchy like there for you?
Yeah. So, as with everything, they're really secretive. So they don't, they definitely didn't ever express to us families who were more influential than others. But you really quickly kind of identify where people sit in. I know, they have, what do they call them? Market days, I think they call them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they have these events on the weekend. They're usually held at the school. And I think that they're just kind of the market is available brides. So they parade the girls around. People come from overseas because obviously, there's a limited gene pool and it's important to spread afar. Otherwise, you end up marrying your cousin. I know that people would be invited to that or not invited. So there's this real kind of...
That's so bizarre.
It's horrifying that there are kids that are born into families who are kind of stuck, but they're not in. That makes sense. So they're not in the fold, really. I feel like they spend all their time trying to be good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is so much a thing. Like, you'll get them, and it all like comes back to that whole the accent thing, the noticeable physically noticeable attributes of the members. And you've got things like the accent, but the other thing too is fashion. So if the higher echelons of the Brethren world, and that not necessarily is always Hales, it's people that were popular, it was people that were money and people that were talented, as in could sing or play the piano or whatever, musical, that they were like the top tier. If you were any of those, you were then like up the top. If not, everyone else, you're down below, and you pine to be part of one of those, fall into one of those categories, right? Either related to the Haleses, had money, were musical, or good looking. Like that was the top bit. So, and what I'm getting at with that is that you'll have those people that set trends that will wear, in my day, it was, there were, I saw the fad of the long denim skirts change to the brand Mimco that they all went through. And then it changed to like puffy headbands were a fad, and then cutting your hair a certain way. Back in my auntie's day, they all had a boof, they used to call it,
LDS.
And then it's one of the trendier girls, the more respected ones, started parting the hair. Then they all did it. You'll notice it more so with the women, because I mean, what else do they have to live for, right? But it's the same thing with the houses. It was a huge theme. Like back in the day, there was folk art. And then it was, meanwhile, this is all like, they're already 30, 40 years behind the rest of the world with these trends. So what I experienced growing up was, from there, it went to like really decorating your houses. And it was like an over the top French provincial gaudy look. And it didn't matter how fake it was, you had it. And if you couldn't afford to wear the Kenzo scarf, you would get onto Little Fish Shop on eBay and buy the fake Kenzo scarf. So you had these people that were setting the trends that were the trend, but bear in mind, those trends are already like 30, 40 years behind. Like they're not current trends. Like, and that's the same with the accent, I believe with the accent thing that particularly the women have, because they don't show, they don't access the outside world like men. They don't work with non-brethren people, and they don't have the materials that men access, like calling up other businesses, like the men do all that. So they're in tune, I think, a bit more with the outside world, whereas the women are sort of stuck in this little cycle. And that's what I was getting at with, you'll find that, like the trends or how they look, or it all comes from one sort of tier of the brethren, women, and the rest of the world. But there's
this really distinct pressure to be like everyone else.
Yeah. So, and it's to be like that higher echelon. Like, I remember my sisters begging mum to change, like when they wanted to change the hair to the part. And you felt ostracized if you didn't do it.
Yeah.
Did you ever witness any alcohol in there with the kids?
So that
sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but so I was just disturbing. Like, you're setting her up for an answer there. Like, that's so obvious.
Yeah. When I first started, I remember the kids had to, as part of one of the subjects, I think it's health, they did a unit on alcohol and they had to create videos. I remember we played the videos. I think it was like maybe a year 9 class or something. Middle high school, they played these educational videos about the dangers of alcohol, and we did it in what was essentially an assembly. And these kids had created a video where they were all sitting around on a veranda drinking. So they had, beer bottles drinking away, and then they piled into a very small hatchback. Now, if there was, because they were driving, if there was actually a supervising adult, they had to have been in the boot. There was no, all the seats were taken. They videoed this thing. So in the video, the kids are driving illegally because none of them were even old enough to have a learner's permit. So,
God.
And then the gist of the story was they had a terrible accident, someone died, and then in the video, the kids were at some poor random person's grave with flowers pretending to be mourning this dead person. So the whole thing was problematic. And I remember standing in this assembly looking around thinking, are any of the other teachers thinking that this is disturbing? This is like so wrong. But sometimes people would have been in the system for so long that they no longer noticed when things were a bit off.
Right. It's that overexposure and then you become desensitized.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for part 2 as we dive into the alcohol issues, testing issues, and end up in tears to Jane's message to One School Global. How can you support Get a Life podcast? You can donate internationally via PayPal at www.paypal.me/getalifepodcast. PayPal also has a QR code that can be scanned. Or donate to our Get a Life podcast GoFundMe. If you're in a high-demand religious group and need help, please go to oliveleaf.network. To share your story or be a guest on the show, email info.getalife@proton.me. Check out www.get-a-life.net for Get a Life merchandise, books, and ways to support or get support. Please remember to like this video, subscribe to Get a Life, and comment.